Was that really a possibility? If so, it scared the hell out of me. Because it was so incredibly unthinkable, so preposterous in a way. But so much that was happening in the world seemed preposterous these days. Out of the corner of my eye, a flash. Suddenly, I was aware of a silver and black motorcycle coming at me on the sidewalk. My heart clutched and I jumped out into the street. I spread my arms and balanced myself to move quickly, left or right, depending on the motorcycle's path. But then I noticed that none of the other pedestrians around me seemed concerned. A smile finally crossed my lips. I remembered Etienne mentioning that oversized motorcycles were popular in Paris and that their riders acted as if they were on much smaller mopeds or scooters, sometimes circumnavigating traffic by going up onto sidewalks. The bike rider, decked out in his blue blazer and tan slacks, was a Paris businessman, not an assassin. He passed by without so much as a nod. I was losing it, wasn't I? But that was understandable. Who wouldn't begin to lose it under this pressure? At 8:45 that morning, I walked to the front of a room full of important French police and army officials. We were inside the Ministère de l'Intérieur, which was located in l'Hôtel Beauvau. We had just over 33 hours left to doomsday. The room was a strange mix of expensive-looking 18th-century-style furniture and genuinely expensive modern technology. In sharp contrast, scenes from London, Paris, Washington, and Tel Aviv played on TV monitors on the walls. Mostly empty streets, heavily armed soldiers and police everywhere. We're at war, I thought to myself, with a madman. I'd been told that I could speak in English to the group, but it would be best if I went slowly and enunciated my words clearly. I figured they were afraid I was going to deliver my talk in street slang that no one in the room would understand. My name is Dr. Alex Cross. I'm a forensic psychologist, I began. I was a homicide detective in Washington, D.C. before I became an agent with the FBI. Less than a year ago, I worked on a case that put me in touch with the Red Mafia. In particular, I was involved with a former KGB man known only as The Wolf. The Wolf is my subject this morning. I could have done the rest in my sleep. For the next 20 minutes, I talked about the Russian. But even as I was finishing up and the question and answer period began, it was clear to me that although the French were willing to listen to what I had to say, they were steadfast in their belief that Islamic terrorists were the real source of the threat to the four targeted cities. Either the Wolf was part of Al-Qaeda, or he was working with them. I was trying to keep my mind open, but if their theory was correct, my mind would be completely blown. I just didn't buy it. The Wolf was Red Mafia. About 11 o'clock, I went back to my cubicle office and found that I had a new partner. Chapter 78. A new partner? Now? Everything was going so fast, it was all a blur to me, often incomprehensible. I had to assume that the FBI had contacted someone and pulled some strings. Someone had. The new partner was an agent de police, a woman named Maude Boulard, who immediately informed me that we would be working in the French police way. Whatever the hell that was supposed to mean. Physically, she was very much like Etienne Marteau, thin, with an aquiline nose and sharp features, but shiny red hair. She went out of her way to tell me she had visited New York and Los Angeles and didn't care for either city at all. Our deadline is close, I told her.
I know the deadline, Dr. Cross. Everyone does. To work fast does not mean to work intelligently.
What she called
our surveillance of the Red Mafia began along the Parc Monceau in the 8th arrondissement.
Unlike in the United States, where the Russians seem to hang out in such working-class neighborhoods as Brighton Beach in New York, the Mafia was apparently situated in pricier digs here.
Maybe because they know Paris better and have operated here longer, Maude suggested. I think so. I have known the Russian thugs for many years. They don't believe in your wolf, by the way. Believe me, I've asked around.
And that's what we did for the next hour or so. Talked about the wolf to Russian thugs Boulard knew. If nothing else, the morning was beautiful, with bright blue skies, which made it excruciating for me. What was I doing there? At 1:30, Maud said cheerfully,
"Let's have lunch, with the Russians, of course. I know just the place."
She took me into what she called
one of the oldest Russian restaurants in Paris,
Le Daru. The front room was paneled with warm pine as if we were inside the dacha of a wealthy Muscovite. I was angry, but trying not to show it. We simply didn't have time for a sit-down lunch. Nevertheless, Maud and I ate. I wanted to strangle her, the obsequious waiter, anybody I could get my hands on. I'm certain she had no idea how angry I was. Some detective. As we finished, I noticed that two men at a nearby table were watching us. Or maybe they were eyeing Maud with her lustrous red hair. I told her about the men and she shrugged it off as,
"The way men are in Paris. Pigs. Let's see if they follow," she said
as we got up and left the restaurant.
"I doubt that they will. I don't know them. I know everybody here. Not your wolf, though."
"They're leaving right behind us," I told her.
"Good for them. It is the exit, after all."
The short Rue Daru ended at Rue de Faubourg, Saint-Honoré, which Maud told me was a window shopping experience that continued all the way to the Place Vendôme. We had walked only a block when a white Lincoln limousine pulled up alongside us. A dark bearded man opened the rear door and looked out.
"Please get in the car. Don't make a scene. Get in now. I'm not fooling around."
"No," said Maud. "We don't get in your car. You come out here and talk to us. Who the hell are you? Who do you think you are?"
The bearded man pulled a gun and fired twice. I couldn't believe what had just happened right in the middle of a Paris street. Maud Boulard was down on the sidewalk, and I was certain she was dead. Blood seeped from a horrible, jagged wound near the center of her forehead. Her red hair was splayed in 100 directions. Her eyes were open wide, staring up into the blue sky. In the fall, one of her shoes had been thrown off and lay out in the middle of the street.
"Get in the car, Dr. Cross. I won't ask you again. I'm tired of being polite,"
said the Russian, whose gun was pointed at my face.
"Get in, or I'll shoot you in the head, too. With pleasure."
Chapter 79.
"Now come show and tell time,"
the black-bearded Russian man said once I was inside the limousine with him.
"Isn't that how they say it in American schools? You have two children in school, don't you? So I'm showing you things that are important, and I'm telling you what they mean. I told a detective to get in the car, and she didn't do it. Maud Boulard was her name, no? Maud Boulard wanted to act like the tough cop. Now she's the dead cop. Not so tough after all."
The car sped away from the murder scene, leaving the French detective dead in the street. We changed cars a few blocks from the shooting, getting into a much less obtrusive gray Peugeot. For what it was worth, I memorized both license plates.
"Now we go for a little ride in the country,"
said the Russian man, who seemed to be having a good time so far. "Who are you? What do you want from me?" I asked him. He was tall, maybe 6'5", and muscular, very much the way I had heard the wolf described. He was holding a Beretta pointed at the side of my head. His hand was rock steady, and he was no stranger to guns and how to use them.
"It doesn't matter who I am, not in the least. You're looking for the wolf, aren't you? I'm taking you to meet him now."
He threw me a dark look, then handed me a cloth sack.
"Put this over your head, and do exactly as I say from now on. Remember, show and tell.
I remember. I put on the hood. I would never forget the cold-blooded murder of Detective Boulard. The wolf and his people killed easily, didn't they? What did that mean for the four cities under threat? Would they kill thousands and thousands so easily? Was that their plan to demonstrate power and control? To get revenge for some mysterious crime in the past? I don't know how long we rode around in the Peugeot, but it was well over an hour. Slow city driving at first, then an hour or so on the open highway. Then we were slowing again, possibly traveling on a dirt road. Hard bounces and bumps shocked and twisted my spine.
You can take the hood off now. We're almost there, Dr. Cross. Nothing much to see out here anyway.
I took off the hood and saw that we were in the French countryside somewhere, riding down an unpaved road with tall grass waving on either side. No markers or signs anywhere that I could see. He's staying out here? I asked. I wondered if I was really being taken to the wolf. For what possible reason?
For the moment, Dr. Cross, but then he'll be gone again. As you know, he moves around a lot. He is like a ghost, an apparition. You'll see what I mean in a moment.
The Peugeot pulled up in front of a small stone farmhouse. Two armed men immediately came out the front door to meet us. Both held automatic weapons aimed at my upper body and face.
Inside,
said one of them. He had a white beard but was nearly as large and muscular as the man who had accompanied me thus far. It was obvious that he had seniority over Blackbeard, who had seemed in control until now.
Inside! Hurry up! Can't you hear, Dr. Cross?
Whitebeard then said to me,
He is an animal. He shouldn't have killed the woman. I am the wolf, Dr. Cross. It's good to meet you at last.
Chapter 80.
Don't try to do anything heroic, by the way, because then I'll have to kill you and find a new messenger,
he said as we walked inside the farmhouse. I'm a messenger now? For what? I asked. The Russian waved off my question as if it were a pesky fly buzzing around his hairy face.
Time is flying. Weren't you thinking that with the French detective? They were just keeping you out of the way, the French. Didn't you think as much?
The thought crossed my mind, I said. Meanwhile, I couldn't believe that this was the wolf. I didn't believe it. But who was he? Why had I been brought there?
Of course it did. You're not a stupid man.
We had entered a small, dark room with a fieldstone fireplace, but no fire. The room was cluttered with heavy wooden furniture, old magazines, yellowing newspapers. The windows were tightly shuttered. The place was airless. The only light came from a single standing lamp. Why am I here? Why show yourself to me now? I finally asked him.
Sit down.
All right. I'm a messenger, I said, and lowered myself into a chair. He nodded.
Yes. A messenger. It's important that everyone fully understand the seriousness of the situation. This is your last chance.
We understand, I said. Almost before I had finished speaking, he lunged forward and hit me in the jaw. My chair went over backward. I was in free fall. Then my head struck the stone floor. I might have gone out for a couple of seconds. But then I was being dragged back up by a couple of the other men in the room. My head was spinning, and there was blood in my mouth.
I want to be clear about this,
the Russian continued. It was as if hitting me had been a necessary pause in his speech.
You are a messenger, and none of you fools understand the seriousness now, just as no one seems to understand, really understand, that they are going to die, and what that means until the moment it happens. The stupid woman in Paris today. Do you think she understood before a speeding bullet blew open her brain? The money must be paid this time, Dr. Cross. In full. In all four cities. The prisoners must be released.
Why the prisoners, I asked. He hit me again, but this time I didn't go down. Then he turned and left the room.
Because I say so.
He came back a moment later with a heavy black valise. He set it on the floor right in front of me.
This is the dark side of the moon,
he said. Then he opened it for me to see inside.
It's called a tactical nuclear explosive device. More simply, a suitcase nuke. Produces a horrific explosion. Unlike conventional warheads, it operates at ground level. Easy to conceal, easy to transport. No mess, no fuss. You've seen pictures of Hiroshima, of course. Everyone has.
What about Hiroshima?
This suitcase has approximately the same yield. Devastating. We, the old Soviet Union, used to manufacture these bombs by the truckload. Want to know where some of the others are right now? Well, there is one or more in Washington, D.C., Tel Aviv, Paris, London. So, as you see, we have a new member in the exclusive nuclear community. We are the new members.
I was starting to feel cold all over. Was there really a nuclear bomb in the suitcase? That's the message you want me to deliver?
The other reactors are in place. And to show my good faith, you can take this reactor back with you. Let the boys in the shop look it over, but tell them to look very quickly. Now maybe you understand. Get out of here. To me, you are a gnat. But at least you are a gnat. Take the nuclear weapon with you. Consider it a gift. Don't say I didn't warn you about what was going to happen. Now go. Hurry, Dr. Cross.
Chapter 81. Everything was a blur from there on that afternoon. The dark cloth hood had just been for show, I figured, since I wore nothing over my eyes on the ride back to Paris, which seemed a lot shorter than the ride out. I kept asking my captors where I was being taken with the suitcase bomb, but neither man in the car would give me an answer. Not a word. They spoke nothing but Russian on the ride.
To me, you are a gnat. Take the nuclear weapon with you.
Soon after we entered Paris, the Peugeot stopped in the crowded parking lot of a shopping center. A gun was held in my face, and then I was handcuffed to the suitcase. What's this about? I asked my captors, but received no answer. Moments later, the Peugeot stopped again, at Place Igor Stravinsky, one of the more populated areas of Paris, though mostly deserted now.
Get out,
I was told, the first English words I'd heard in close to an hour. Slowly, carefully, I emerged from the sedan with the bomb. I felt a little dizzy. The Peugeot roared off. I was aware of a certain liquidity in the air, particles, a real sense of atoms. I stood motionless near the huge plaza of the Centre National d'Art et de Culture Georges Pompidou, handcuffed to a black valise that weighed at least 50 pounds, probably more. Supposedly, it carried a nuclear bomb, the full equivalent of the ones Harry Truman had ordered dropped on Japan. My body was already covered with cold sweat, and I felt as if I were watching myself in a dream. Could it all end like this? Of course it could. All bets were off, but especially any bets on my life. Was I about to be blown up? Would I suffer radiation sickness if I wasn't? I spotted two policemen near a Virgin Records store and made my way up to them. I explained who I was and then told them to please call the Directeur de la Sécurité Publique. I didn't tell the cops what was in the black valise, but I quickly revealed the contents to the director when he came on the line.
Is the threat real, Dr. Cross?
Is the bomb live? I don't know. How could I? Please respond as if it is. That's what I'm doing. Get your bomb squad over here now. Get off the phone. Within a few minutes, the whole of the Beaubourg district had been evacuated. Except for a dozen or so patrolmen, the military police, and several bomb squad experts. At least I hope they were experts, the best France had to offer. I was told to sit on the ground, which I did, right alongside the black valise, of course. I did everything I was told to do because I had no choice in the matter. I was feeling sick to my stomach, and sitting made it a little better, though not much. At least the initial dizziness I'd felt was starting to pass. First, a bomb-sniffing dog was brought in to smell me and the suitcase. A handsome young German shepherd, the Chien Explo, approached very cautiously, eyeing the suitcase as if it were a rival dog, an enemy. When the shepherd got within 5 yards, she completely froze. A low growl rumbled from her chest. The hair on her neck rose. Oh, shit. Oh, God, I thought. The dog continued to growl until she was certain of radioactive contents. Then she quickly retreated to her handlers. Very wise of the shepherd. I was left alone again. I'd never been more frightened in my life. Nothing had come even close. The thought of being blown apart, possibly vaporized, isn't pleasant. It's a tough one to wrap your mind around. After what seemed like an eternity, though it was only a few minutes, two bomb squad technicians in moon suits cautiously headed my way. I saw that one of them was clutching bolt cutters. God bless him. This was such an incredibly surreal moment. The man with the cutters knelt down beside me.
"It's okay. You're okay," he whispered.
Then he carefully sliced through the handcuffs.
"You can leave. Get up slowly," he said.
I rose cautiously, rubbing my wrist, but already backing away from the suitcase. My alien-looking escorts and I hurried out of the designated hot zone to where two black bomb squad vans were parked. Of course, the van was still in the hot zone as well. If a nuclear bomb went off, at least a square mile of Paris would be vaporized instantly. From inside one of the vans, I watched the team of technicians work to deactivate the bomb. If they could. I never considered leaving the scene, and the next few minutes were the longest of my life. No one in the van spoke, and we were all holding our breath. The idea of dying like this, so suddenly, was almost impossible to conceive. Word came back from the French bomb technicians.
"The suitcase is open."
Then, less than a minute later,
"The fissile material is there. It's real. It seems to be in working order, unfortunately."
The bomb was real. It wasn't a fake threat. The wolf was still keeping his promises, wasn't he? The sadistic bastard was everything he said he was. Then I saw one of the technicians pump his arm in the air. A cheer went up around the console in the van. I didn't understand exactly what had happened at first, but it seemed like good news. No one explained anything to me. "What just happened?" I finally asked in French. One of the techs turned to me.
"There's no trigger. It couldn't blow up. They didn't want it to explode, thank God. They only wanted to scare the shit out of us."
"It worked," I told him. "I shit you not." Chapter 82. Over the next couple of hours, it was revealed that the suitcase bomb had everything necessary for a nuclear explosion, except a single part, a pulsed neutron emitter, a trigger. All the difficult elements were there. I couldn't eat that night, couldn't keep anything down, couldn't concentrate at all. I'd been tested, but I couldn't get the idea of radiation poisoning to leave my brain. I also couldn't get Maud Boulard out of my mind. Her face, the tenor of her voice, our absurd lunch together, the detective's stubbornness and naivete, her red hair splayed out on the sidewalk, the casual brutality of the wolf and his people. I kept flashing back to the Russian who had struck me in the farmhouse. Had it been the wolf? Why would he let me see him? And then, why not? I went back to the Hotel Ribet and suddenly wished that I hadn't asked for a room facing the street. My body felt numb all over, exhausted, but my mind wouldn't stop racing at warp speed. The noise rising from the street was a disturbance that I couldn't handle right now. They have nuclear weapons. This isn't a bluff. It's going to happen. A holocaust. I decided to call the kids at about 6 o'clock their time. I talked to them about all the things in Paris that I didn't see that day. Everything except what had really happened to me. So far, the media had none of it, but that wouldn't last. Then I called Nana. I told her the truth about how it had felt sitting on the pavement with a bomb attached to my wrist. She was the one I always told about my worst days, and this was probably the worst of them all. Chapter 83. When I arrived at my small office at the prefecture, I got another surprise. Martin Lodge was waiting there for me. It was 7:15, 10 hours and 45 minutes to doomsday. I shook Martin's hand and told him how glad I was that he was there. Not much time left. Why are you here? Last words, I suppose. I have to give the final update on the situation in London, as well as Tel Aviv, from our vantage point, anyway. And? Martin shook his head. You don't want to hear the same rotten story twice. Yeah, I do. Not this story, you don't. Oh, hell, it's all cocked up, Alex. I think he might have to blow up a city to get them to act. That's how bad it is. The worst is Tel Aviv. I think it's basically hopeless there. They don't make deals with terrorists. You asked. The morning briefing started at 8 sharp and included a quick summary on the briefcase bomb from the technicians who had taken it apart. They reported that the bomb was authentic in design, but there was no neutron emitter, no trigger, and possibly not enough radioactive material inside. An army general spoke about the current situation in Paris. The people were frightened and staying off the streets, but only a small percentage had actually fled the city. The army was prepared to move in and declare martial law about the time of the deadline, which was 6 p.m. Then it was time for Martin. He strode to the front of the room and spoke in French. Good morning. Isn't it incredible what can happen once we adapt ourselves to a new reality? The people of London have been splendid for the most part. Some rioting. Not too much in terms of what could have happened. I suspect that those who might have given us the most trouble got out of London early. As for Tel Aviv, they're so accustomed to crisis and living under threatening scenarios. Let's just say that they're handling this very well. Anyway, that's the good news. The bad is that we've raised most of the money, but not all of it. That's in London. And Tel Aviv? As best we can tell, they are not going to make a deal. The Israelis hold their cards very close to the vest, so we're not sure what's transpired there. We're putting on pressure, of course, and so is Washington. I know that private individuals have been approached to put up the entire ransom. That could still happen. But it isn't clear if the government will take the money. They simply don't want to meet terrorist demands. Less than 10 hours. Martin Lodge said. To be blunt, we don't have time for a lot of bullshit. Somebody has to drop the hammer on anyone who's resisting paying the ransom. A policeman had come up to me and was whispering against my ear.
Sorry, you're needed, Dr. Cross.
What is it? I whispered back. I wanted to hear everything that was being said in this meeting.
Just come. It's an emergency. Right now, please.
Chapter 84. I knew that, ironically, an emergency had to be considered good news at this point in the countdown. At 8:30 that morning, I was inside a speeding police cruiser, the blare of its siren disturbing the peace all along our route across Paris. My God, the streets were bleak and deserted. Except for soldiers and the police, anyway. My part in an ongoing interrogation was explained to me during the ride.
We have an arms dealer in custody, Dr. Cross. We have reasons to believe that he helped supply the bombs. Maybe he's one of the men who you saw out in the country. He's a Russian, with a white beard.
Minutes later, we arrived in front of the Brigade Criminelle, a dark 19th century building in a quiet neighborhood along the Seine. Actually, this was the infamous La Crime from countless French movies and police stories, including several about Inspector Maigret that Nana and I had read together when I was a kid. Life imitates art, or something like that. Once inside La Crime, I was led up a rickety staircase all the way to the top floor, the fourth. The interrogation was being conducted up there. I was brought down a narrow hallway to room 414. The brigadier who escorted me knocked once, and then we stepped inside. I recognized the Russian arms dealer instantly. They had caught Whitebeard, the one who'd told me he was the Wolf. Chapter 85. The room was small and cramped, and it was situated right under the eaves. It had a low, rain-stained, sloping ceiling and a tiny velux, a skylight. I looked at my watch. 8:45. Tick, tick, tick. I was hurriedly introduced to the interrogation team of Captain Corridon and Lieutenant Leroux, and their prisoner, a Russian arms dealer, Artur Nikitin. I already knew Nikitin, of course. He wore no shirt or shoes and was cuffed, hands behind his back. He was also sweating profusely. He was definitely the white-bearded Russian from the farmhouse. I had been told during the ride over that the Russian hoodlum did business with Al-Qaeda that had made him millions. It was believed that he was involved with suitcase nukes, that he knew how many had been sold, and that he knew who had bought them.
Cowards!
He was shouting at the French police as I entered the room.
Fucking goddamn cowards! You can't do this to me! I've done nothing wrong! You French claim to be such liberals, but you're not.
He looked at me and pretended he had no idea who I was. His bad acting made me smile. Captain Corridon told him,
You may have noticed that you have been brought to the Préfecture de Police rather than the offices of the DST. That's because you are not being charged as an illegal trafficker in arms. The charge is murder. We are homicide detectives. Trust me, there are no liberals in this room, unless it's you.
Nikitin's brown eyes remained wide with anger, but I also detected traces of confusion, especially now that I was there.
This is bullshit! I can't believe it. I've done nothing wrong. I am a businessman, a French citizen. I want my lawyer.
Corridon looked at me.
You try.
I stepped forward and threw a hard uppercut into the Russian's jaw. His head snapped back. We're not even close to being even, I told him. No one knows that you're here. You will be tried as a terrorist and you will be executed. No one will care, not after tomorrow. Not after your bombs helped destroy Paris and kill thousands. The Russian yelled at me.
I tell you again, I've done nothing. You can't do anything to me. What weapons? What bombs? Who am I, Saddam Hussein? You can't do this.
We can and we will execute you, shouted Captain Corridon from off to the side. You're a dead man as soon as you leave this room, Nikitin. We have other scum to talk to. Whoever helps us first, we help them. Get him out of here, Corridon finally said. We are wasting time with this bastard.
The brigadier grabbed Nikitin by his hair and by the band of his pants. He threw him halfway across the room. The Russian's head smacked against the wall, but he scrambled to his bare feet. His eyes were large and fearful now. Maybe he was beginning to understand that the rules of interrogation had changed. Everything had changed now. Last chance to talk, I said. Remember, you're just a gnat to us.
I didn't sell anything to anyone here in France. I sell in Angola for diamonds.
I don't care and I don't believe you, Captain Corridon shouted at the top of his voice. Get him out of here.
I know something,
Nikitin suddenly blurted out.
The suitcase nukes. The number is 4. It's Al-Qaeda who is behind it. Al-Qaeda made the plan. They call the shots, the prisoners of war, everything.
I turned to the French policeman and shook my head. The wolf gave him up to us, and he's not going to be pleased with his performance. He'll kill him for us. I don't believe a word he just said. Nikitin looked at the three of us. Then he spit.
Al-Qaeda, fuck you if you don't like it or believe it.
I stared back at him. Prove what you're saying. Make us believe you. Make me believe you, because I don't.
All right. I can do that. I'll make all of you believers.
Chapter 86. As soon as I arrived back at the prefecture, Martin Lodge caught up with me.
Let's go.
He started to pull me along. What? Go where? I looked at my watch, something I seemed to be doing every couple of minutes now. It was 10:25.
A raid is going down in a few minutes. The hideout that the Russian gave you. It's real.
Martin and I hurried upstairs to the crisis room at police headquarters. My old pal Etienne Marteau met us and guided us to a row of monitors set up to view the raid. Everything was happening incredibly fast for a change. Too fast, maybe. But what choice did we have?
Marteau said, "They are confident, Alex. They coordinated with the power authority, FDF, GDF. The power grid in the area goes down, and then they go in."
I nodded at what he was saying and watched the screens in front of us. It was strange to be once removed from the action. Then it was happening. French soldiers appeared out of nowhere, dozens of them. They wore RAID jackets,
Recherche, Assistance, Intervention et Dissuasion.
They carried assault rifles. The soldiers rushed toward a small townhouse that looked harmless enough. They broke down the front door. It happened in seconds. A UBL, a French version of the Hummer, appeared and crashed through a wooden gate in the rear. Soldiers jumped from the UBL. "We'll see soon enough," I said to Martin. "RAID is good at what they do?"
"Yes. They are skilled at destruction and death."
A couple of the French police were mic'd and carried cameras, so we got to see and hear much of the raid as it happened. A door was thrown open, a gun fired from inside, then a blaze of return fire. Someone's shrill scream, the sound of a body thumping against the floorboards. Two gunmen ran out into a narrow hallway, both in their underwear, shot down before they knew what hit them. A half-naked female with a handgun, shot in the throat. "Don't kill them all," I muttered at the monitor. A Cougar helicopter swooped down and more commandos appeared. Inside the house, soldiers swarmed into a bedroom, then fell on a man lying on a cot. They took him alive, thank God. Other terrorists were surrendering, their hands held high. Then more rapid gunshots, off camera this time. A suspect was marched down the hall with a gun held to his head. An older man.
The wolf?
Was it possible they had captured him? The policeman with the gun was smiling as if he had scored something big. The raid was certainly fast and efficient. At least 4 of the terrorists had been captured alive. Then we waited impatiently for news. The cameras at the raid site were shut down. We waited some more. Finally, about 3 in the afternoon, an army colonel stood at the front of the room in the crisis center. Every seat was taken. There was no more standing room. The tension was almost unbearable. The colonel began.
"We have identified the prisoners, those who are alive. One from Iran, a Saudi, a Moroccan, 2 Egyptians, a cell, Al-Qaeda. We know who they are. It is doubtful that we caught the wolf. It is also doubtful that these terrorists were involved in the threat to Paris. I am sorry to give you bad news at this late hour. We did our best, but he remains a step ahead of us. I am sorry.
Chapter 87.
The terrible final deadline was so close now, and no one had any more information on what would happen next. We seemed to have run out of options to stop the wolf. At 5:45, I was one of several nervous men and women climbing out of dark Renaults and then hurrying toward the tall ironwork gates of the Ministère de l'Intérieur building for a meeting with the DGSE, which is the French equivalent of our CIA. The front gates were immense. Like supplicants entering a cathedral, we seemed small and insignificant as we passed through them. I felt small and insignificant, as well as at the mercy of higher powers, and not just God. The gates opened onto a grand courtyard, a vast expanse of cobblestones, and I was reminded of the horse-drawn carriages that had once rolled through these very gates. Had there been progress in the world since then? It didn't seem like it on that particular day. I walked with other police officers, government ministers, and directors into a magnificent entry hall with a marbled pink and white tile floor. Armed guards lined the staircase. Hardly anyone spoke on the way up. There was only the dull sound of our plodding footsteps, the occasional nervous cough. It was possible that within the hour, Paris, London, Washington, and Tel Aviv would be bombed and thousands would die. There could be a much higher number of casualties. 100,000 or more was a possibility. A Russian gangster is doing this? One with mysterious ties to Al-Qaeda? We're at his mercy now, aren't we? How incredibly strange. The meeting was in the Salle des Fêtes, and once again I couldn't help wondering what I was doing there. I was the American representative in Paris because the FBI wanted me there, because there was a chance that I could make a difference with my experience as a psychologist and homicide detective, because something tragic might have happened to the wolf in Paris a long time ago. We still hadn't figured out what. Inside the main hall, tables had been arranged in a U-shape and covered with plain white fabric. Propped on easels were laminated maps of Europe, the Middle East, and the United States. The target areas were circled in thick red crayon. Crude, but effective. A dozen or more TV monitors were up and running. So was a state-of-the-art teleconferencing system. There were more gray and blue suits than usual, more important people, more obvious power on display. For some reason, I noticed several pairs of rimless titanium eyeglasses, the ever-fashionable French. Live scenes from London, Washington, Paris, and Tel Aviv played on the TV monitors mounted on the walls. The cities were quiet. Most of the army and police were inside as well. Etienne Marteau came and sat beside me. Martin Lodge had already returned to London.
What do you think our chances are, realistically, here in Paris, Alex?
Etienne asked. Etienne, I don't know what's happening. No one does. Maybe we stopped the main cell of terrorists earlier. My guess is that everything has been leading up to today's deadline. I think the wolf knew how difficult it would be to pull this together. Something happened to him here in Paris. We still don't know what it is. What can I say? We're out of time. We're fucked. Suddenly, Etienne sat up straight in his chair.
My God! It's President Dubonnet.
Chapter 88. Aramis Dubonnet, the French president, looked to be in his mid-50s and was very well dressed for the occasion, very formal. He was a compact man with slicked back silver-gray hair and a pencil-thin mustache, and he wore wire-rimmed eyeglasses. He looked somewhat calm and in control of his emotions as he strode quickly to the front of the room and began to talk. You could hear a pin drop.
As you know, I have worked in the trenches and on the front lines of law enforcement for many years myself. So I wanted you to hear from me now. I also wanted to be with you for these final minutes before the deadline runs out. I have news. The money has been raised in Paris, in London, Washington, and in Tel Aviv, with help from many friends of Israel around the world. The entire sum will be transferred in 3.5 minutes, approximately 5 minutes before the deadline expires. I want to thank everyone in this room and all of those you represent for countless hours of hard work, for personal sacrifices that no one should ask, for the most heroic effort, incredible bravery by so many. We did the best that we could, and most important, we will survive this crisis. Eventually, we will get these inhuman bastards, all of them. We will get this wolf, the most inhuman of them all.
There was a gold empire clock on the wall behind the president. Everyone watched it intently. How could we not? At 5:55 Paris time, President Dubonnet said,
"The money is being transferred now. It will happen in a matter of seconds. All right, it's done. This should be over now. We will be all right. Congratulations to all of you. Thank you."
There was an audible sigh of relief in the cavernous room. Smiles and handshakes, some hugs. Then we waited, almost a reflex action, for any kind of communication from the wolf, for breaking news from the other targeted cities, Washington, London, Tel Aviv. The final 60 seconds before the deadline were incredibly tense and dramatic, even though the ransom had been delivered. I could do nothing but watch the second hand on the clock. Finally, I said a prayer for my family, for the people in all four cities, for the world we live in. Then it was 6 in Paris and London, 12 in Washington, 7 in Tel Aviv. The deadline had passed. But what did it mean? Were we truly safe? There were no significant changes on any of the monitors, no disruptions, no explosions on the live video feeds, nothing. And there was no call from the wolf. 2 more minutes passed. 10 minutes. And then a terrible explosion rocked the room and the world.
Part 5.
Deliver us from evil.
Chapter 89.
The bomb, or bombs, not nuclear, but powerful enough to cause massive damage, went off in the first arrondissement, near the Louvre. The entire area, a maze of lanes and dead-end streets, was nearly flattened. Close to 1,000 people died immediately, or at least within a few seconds. The terrible multiple explosions were heard and felt all over Paris. The Louvre suffered only minor damage from the blasts, but the three-block area covering Rue de Marengo, Rue de l'Oratoire, and Rue Bailleul was almost completely destroyed, as was a nearby bridge, a small one, crossing the Seine. A bridge. Another bridge. In Paris this time. Not a word of explanation was heard from the wolf. He didn't take credit for the wanton and despicable act, nor did he deny it. He didn't need to explain his actions, did he? He thought he was God. There are other supremely arrogant people who labor inside our government in Washington, and also some who work in the national media, who believe that they can accurately predict what will happen in the future because they know, or think they know, what happened in the past. I suspect it's the same in Paris, London, Tel Aviv, and everywhere else in the world. All these basically intelligent, maybe even well-intentioned people who proclaim, "That couldn't happen," or "Here's how it would happen in the real world," as if they really know. But they don't know. Nobody knows. All bets are off nowadays. Anything can happen, and sooner or later, it probably will. We don't seem to be getting any smarter as a species, just crazier and crazier. Or at the very least, a whole lot more dangerous. Unbelievably, unbearably more dangerous. Or maybe that was just my mood as I flew back from Paris. A terrible, terrible tragedy had occurred there after all. The wolf had won, if what he did could be called winning, and it hadn't even been a close contest. A power-mad Russian gangster had adopted the tactics of terrorism, or so it seemed. He was better than we were, more organized, more cunning, and far more brutal when he needed results. I couldn't even remember the last time we'd had a victory in our battle with the wolf and his forces. He was smarter. I just prayed that it was over now. Could it be? Or was it another calm before another storm? I couldn't bear to think about that possibility. I arrived home a little before 3 on a Thursday afternoon. The kids were back. Nana had never left Fifth Street. When I got there, I insisted on cooking dinner. Wouldn't take no for an answer. It was what I needed. Cook a good meal, talk to Nana and the kids about anything we wanted to talk about, get lots of hugs. Not have a single thought about what had happened in Paris, or the wolf, or any kind of police work. So I made my interpretation of a French-style dinner, and I even spoke French with Damon and Janny while the meal was being prepared. Janny set the dining table with Nana's silver, cloth napkins, a lace tablecloth that we used only for special occasions. The meal? Langoustin, rôti, brunoise, de papaye, poivron, et saignant doux. Prawns with papaya, peppers, and onions. For a main course, chicken stew and a sweet red wine sauce. We drank small glasses of wine with the meal, a delightful minervois, and ate with enthusiasm. But for dessert, brownies and ice cream. I was back in America, after all. I was home. Thank God. Chapter 90. Home again, home again. The next day I didn't go to work, and the kids stayed out of school. It seemed to satisfy everybody's needs, even Nana Mama's, who encouraged us all to play hooky. I called Jamila a couple of times, and talking to her helped, as it always did. But something seemed off between us. For our day of hooky playing, I took the kids on a day trip to St. Michael's, Maryland, which is situated on Chesapeake Bay. The village turned out to be a lively snapshot of quaint coastal charm, a thriving marina, a couple of small inns with rockers set out on the porches, even a lighthouse. And the Chesapeake Bay Maritime Museum, where we got to watch real shipwrights working on a skipjack restoration. It felt as though we were back in the 19th century, which didn't seem like such a bad idea. After lunch at the Crab Claw restaurant, we embarked on an actual skipjack charter. Nana Mama had taken her school classes there many times over the years, but she stayed home this trip, protesting that she had too much work to do around the house. I only hoped she was really feeling okay. I still remembered the way she used to teach her students on the field trips, so I took over as the guest lecturer. Janny and Damon, this is the last fleet of working sailing vessels in North America. Can you imagine? These ships have no winches, just manpower and blocks and tackles. The fishermen are called watermen, I told them, just as Nana had told her classes years before. Then off we went to the Mary Merchant for a 2.5-hour cruise into the past. The captain and his mate showed us how to hoist a sail with a block and tackle, and soon we had caught a breeze with a loud whoosh and the rhythmic smack of waves against the hull. What an afternoon it was. Gazing up at a 60-foot mast made from a single log shipped all the way from Oregon. The smells of salt air, linseed oil, residual oyster shells. The closeness of my two eldest children, the look of trust and love in their eyes. Most of the time, anyway. We passed stands of pine woods, open fields where tenant farmers raised corn and soybean, and great white-columned estates that had once been plantations. I almost felt as if I were back in another century, and it was a good break, much needed R&R. Only a couple of times did I drift into thoughts of police work, but I quickly pulled myself back. I half listened as the captain explained that only boats under sail can dredge for oysters, except twice a week when engine-powered yawls were allowed on the bay. I suspected that it was a clever conservation ploy to make the watermen work hard for their oysters, otherwise the supply might run out. What a fine day. As the boat heeled to starboard, the boom swung out, the mainsail and jib filled the air with a loud smack, and Janny, Damon, and I squinted into the setting sun. And we understood, for a little while anyway, that this had something to do with the way life was supposed to be lived, and maybe even why such moments needed to be cherished and remembered. "Best day of my life," Janny told me. "I'm not even exaggerating too much." "Same here," I said. "And I'm not exaggerating at all." Chapter 91. When we got home early that evening, I saw a scuffed-up white van parked in front of the house. I recognized the bright green logo on the door, Home Care Health Project. What was this? Why was Dr. Coles there? Suddenly, I was nervous that something had happened to Nana while I was out with the kids. The fragile state of her health had been on my mind more and more lately. The reality that she was in her mid-80s now, though she wouldn't tell exactly how old she was, or rather she lied about it. I hurried out of the car and up the front steps ahead of the kids by a couple of strides. "I'm in here with Kayla," Nana called as I opened the front door and Damon and Janny slid by me on either side. "We're just kicking back, Alex. No need for alarm. Take your time." "So who's alarmed?" I asked, as I slowed and walked into the living room, saw the two of them kicking back on the sofa.
"You were, Mr. Worrywart. You saw the health truck outside, and what did you think?"
"Sickness," said Nana.
She and Kayla both laughed merrily, and I had to smile too, at myself. I made a very weak protest. "Never happened."
"Then why did you rush up the front steps like your trousers were on fire?"
"Oh, forget it, Alex," Nana said, and laughed some more.
Then she waved her hand as if to chase away any unwanted negativity in the room.
"Come, sit down with us for a minute or two. Can you spare it? Tell me everything. How was St. Michael's? Has it changed very much?"
"Oh, I suspect that St. Michael's is pretty much the same as it was 100 years ago.
"Which is a good thing," Nana said. "Thank God for small favors."
I went over and gave Kayla a kiss on the cheek. She had helped Nana when she was sick a while back, and now she stopped in regularly. Actually, I'd known Kayla since we were both growing up in the neighborhood. She was one of us who got out, received an education, and then came back to give back. The Home Care Health Project brought doctors to the homes of the sick in Southeast. Kayla had started it, and she kept it going with incredibly hard work, including fundraising, which she mostly did herself.
"You look good," I told her. The words just came out.
"Yes, I lost some weight, Alex," she said, and cocked an eyebrow at me. "It's all this running around that I do. I try my best to keep the weight on, but it just comes off, damn it."
I had noticed. Kayla is close to 6 feet, but I had never seen her looking so trim and fit, not even when she was a kid. She always had a sweet, pretty face and a disposition to match.
"It also sets a better example for folks," she said. "Too many people in the neighborhood are overweight. Too many are obese, even a lot of the kids. They think it's in their genes."
Then Kayla laughed.
"Plus, I must admit, it has helped my social life, my outlook on things, whatever. Whatever.
Well, you always look good to me, I said, putting my foot in it again. Kayla rolled her eyes at Nana. He lies so easily. He's really good at it. They both laughed again. Anyway, thank you for the compliment, Alex, said Kayla. I'll take it for what it's worth. I don't even consider it too condescending. Oh, you know what I mean. I decided I'd better change the topic. So Nana is fine and going to live to 100? I would expect so, Kayla said. But Nana frowned. Why do you want to get rid of me so soon? She asked. What did I do to deserve that? I laughed. Maybe it's because you're a constant pain in my butt. You know that, don't you? Of course I know it, Nana said. That's my job in life. My reason for being is to torment you. Don't you know that yet? And as she said those words, I finally felt that I was home again. Really home. Back from the wars. I took Kayla and Nana out to the sun porch and played An American in Paris for them. That's what I had been not too long ago, but no more. About 11, I walked Kayla out to her health van. We stopped and talked for a moment on the front